Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight isn't currently hosting in-person gatherings, we're still striving for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country and the world, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Once you've listened to the conversation, you can purchase the books mentioned in this podcast at Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn or on our website at greenlightbookstore.com.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. I'm Chelsea from Greenlight, and we're thrilled to host tonight's event with Maisha Cherry presenting her new book, The Case for Rage, Why Anger is Essential to Anti-Racist Struggle. She'll be talking with Jacqueline Woodson, so you're in for an excellent time. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thanks to Maisha, Jacqueline, and the team at Oxford University Press for making this happen, and to all of you for showing up. Although we're not able to host events in our store spaces, our community of authors and readers is still here. We're grateful for your support and for the chance to make this space for conversation and connection. And importantly, tonight's featured book, The Case for Rage, is available for sale from Greenlight Bookstore. You can shop in person from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. at both our Fulton Street and Flatbush Ave stores, where you can purchase Maisha's book and many others on site. You can also order online at greenlightbookstore.com for a quick pickup at the store or for shipping anywhere in the US. If you care about supporting the careers of authors and the ongoing existence of independent bookstores, buying tonight's featured book is a great way to show your support. Our interviewer tonight is Jacqueline Woodson, the recipient of a 2020 MacArthur Fellowship and many other accolades. She was the 2018-2019 National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, and her New York Times bestselling memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, won the National Book Award, as well as the Coretta Scott King Award, a Newbery Honor, and the NAACP Image Award. She also wrote the adult books Red at the Bone and Another Brooklyn, a 2016 National Book Award finalist. Her dozens of books for young readers have won Newbery Honors and the Jane Addams Children's Book Award. Woodson will be speaking with our featured author, Maisha Cherry. Cherry is assistant professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside. Her books include Unmuted, Conversations on Prejudice, Oppression, and Social Justice, and co-edited with Owen Flanagan, The Moral Psychology of Anger. Her work on emotions and race has appeared in The Atlantic, Boston Review, Los Angeles Times, and several other publications. Cherry is also the host of the Unmute podcast, where she interviews philosophers about the social and political issues of our day. Her next book, The Failures of Forgiveness, is forthcoming with Princeton University Press. In her newest book, The Case for Rage, Cherry makes an argument for anti-racist anger by putting Aristotle in conversation with Audre Lorde, James Baldwin in conversation with Joseph Butler. The Case for Rage not only uses the tools of philosophy to articulate its arguments, but it sharpens them with the help of social psychology and history. Maisha is going to start us off with a reading from the book, and then she'll be talking with Jacqueline and with all of you. Maisha and Jacqueline, please take it away.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I'm gonna read from chapter 7, titled The End of Rage, and skip around slightly. On April 28, 1973, a 10-year-old Black boy, Clifford Glover, shot and killed by a white New York City police officer. The officer was indicted for his murder, but eventually acquitted of charges by a jury of his peers. 11 of the 12 were white men. Audre Lorde heard the verdict on the radio while driving from the airport. Sickened with fury, blinded by rage, writes her biographer, she pulled her car over. On the side of the road, she wrote a poem titled Power. She says, I am trapped on a desert of raw gunshot wounds and a dead child dragging his shattered black face off the edge of my sleep. Blood from his punctured cheeks and shoulders is the only liquid for miles. She continues, A policeman who shot down a 10-year-old in Queens stood over the boy with his cop shoes and childish blood. This policeman said in his own defense, "I didn't know the size, know nothing else, only the color." Reflecting on her own agency and the future, she writes, "I have not been able to touch the destruction within me. But unless I learn to use the difference between poetry and rhetoric, my power too will run corrupt as poisonous mold or lie limp and useless as an unconnected wire." In this moment, Audre Lorde is faced with the reality of Black death at the hands of the police, as well as the justice system's shameful and inadequate response to it. Nevertheless, she is trying to figure out how to use her own power and anger, not to destroy or corrupt, but to wield it in useful ways. She's also reminding us of the power we all possess. In order to make use of this power, there are some things we must learn first. The book I hope you have in your hands, or you will get in your hands, was written on the proverbial side of the road. I wrote and revised it upon hearing about the raw gunshot wounds that pierced the Black skin of Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, Breonna Taylor, Michael Brown, and others whose killers were never indicted, or when indicted, were acquitted. I wrote this on the side of the road as I attempted to make some sense of the mysterious and not so mysterious treatment of Sandra Bland and Freddie Gray in police custody, and Eric Garner and George Floyd and the police's deadly grip. I wrote this on the side of the road as the nation gasped and wept at the actions of a white supremacist who killed non-Black churchgoers who had only moments earlier welcomed him with a smile one summer evening in Charleston, South Carolina. I pulled over to write this book as I witnessed video footage and images of a white nationalist and a militia member kill anti-racist protesters and politicians and white citizens attempt to justify it, by refusing to believe that nothing could be done to combat this racism and these injustices. I wrote and rewrote this book to figure out what was within me, us, and how we could use our own power through the simmering anger that was arising within us. One thing I know for sure is that if anti-racist anger is in response to racism, and racism is resilient, then the rage must be just as resilient as the racism to combat it. The way that anger remains resilient is by playing the role that I describe in the book. Here's a recap of the role of anger in anti-racist struggle. This anger, or this Lordian rage, communicates the value of lies, particularly the racially marginalized and oppressed. It alarms us to racism and racial injustice in its explicit and subtle forms. It advertises racial justice worth. It makes us believe that we can change things. It makes us want to take risks to impact the future. It makes us optimistic that we can be and make a less racist and more just world possible. It motivates us to engage in productive action to end racial injustice. It allows us to resist racial rules that says that only whites have a right to assert their value and receive respect. It allows us to resist racial rules that declares that whiteness and white supremacy should be the norm. It also turns us into rage renegades. Like Baldwin said, you don't need to cool it first in order to engage in an anti-racist struggle, because anti-racist anger is aimed at radical change, has an inclusive perspective, motivates productive action, and is also compatible with and complementary to care, compassion, empathy, and love. Those who are angry needn't become more respectable or palatable to others in order to engage productively in the struggle. They already have what they need to use their power.
Fabulous. Thanks so much for reading to us. And you do read beautifully, so embrace it.
Jackie made me read for those who don't, don't know the inside thing.
You just have to. The book is so filled with all of these morsels of ways in which we can activate. And I think the first thing that struck me was this issue of turning anger into action, especially as Black women, especially as queer women. So I love that you open with that, with the part about Lord. And I want to ask you, the book opens with you talking about the first time you heard the N-word. I want to know, when was the first time you learned about Lord?
So around about 2012, the whole Trayvon Martin thing. We know that was the rise of Black Lives Matter. A lot of people were angry, protesting in the streets. I was angry and just trying to make sense of what I was feeling, but also kind of bothered by people's criticism, particularly pundits, politicians' criticism of that anger. So for the first time, I decided to engage in it as an intellectual exercise, just trying to figure out what is anger, right? So I went to the philosophical canon, as philosophical nerds often do, and just try to read a lot of literature about particularly what feminist philosophers had to say about anger in the context of gender oppression. And one of the things that I noticed is that all of these feminist philosophers, these white women with PhDs in philosophy, their main source of engagement was The Uses of Anger by Audre Lorde. And so I'm reading like essay after essay, journal article after journal article, and they keep talking about this Black woman. So I'm going to the source. So I went to the source, read the essay, and I was just blown away. And now I've read it over 100 times. Each time I read it, I get new insights. Each time I teach it, I get new insights. And then I got just addicted to her essays in general and her poetry in general. So strange to say, white women put me on the Audre Lorde, strange as that may be. But, but white women who were very much concerned about anger, and we know that this is not the only essay which Lorde talks about anger, but they relied on her as a resource, as an intellectual resource. And I'm so glad. I'm so glad that they did.
Wow. That's something I didn't realize that. When was the essay published? Do you know what year?
I think it was 1981. I could be off a year or two.
That's something. Before I ask about Lorde and Rage, I want to, and maybe a lot of people know, but what does it mean to be a moral psychologist and philosopher?
So I like moral psychology because in some ways I get to merge a lot of questions in philosophy and also in psychology, right? And so to say that I'm a moral psychologist says that I'm very much concerned with kind of psychological mechanisms. And emotions is a psychological mechanism, right? And so I'm very captivated by emotions. The people who know me know that I, you know, trying to make sense of how I feel and when I feel it. And I know I'm not the only one. But what happens is it's not that I'm just interested in these particular emotions, but I'm very interested in what they say about our moral lives. How do they inform our moral lives? How do they make us better? How do they make us worse? Can they make any contribution in the political or public sphere? And what ways are they destructive? And which ways are they constructive? What do they tell us about ourselves and our world? And so that's where you're able to kind of like mix the psychological elements with the philosophical elements. Because some of the foundational questions about philosophy is how do I first make sense of this world that I live in? But how do I create a better world for myself, for comrades, for political fellows? And what gets in the way of that? And what can I do to make things better? So that's what it means to be a moral psychologist. And particularly what I try to do is try to figure out how I can take those questions and those insights and apply it to issues around race and issues around gender.
Wow. And early on, you talk about the fact that a lot of your students are of color, people of the global community, BIPOC, and also global majority, and also a lot of them are first generation college students. Sure. And I just wanted to be in your classroom, but I was curious about the engagement with them. Let me ask that question second. First of all, can you, for the audience, define Lorde and Rage?
Okay. So Lorde and Rage is basically what I call kind of a noble or a virtuous anti-racist anger. It's an anger that arises in the context of racial injustice or political injustice. But it's a productive kind. It's a kind that has the power to say that certain people's lives matter. It's a kind that can motivate productive action. It's a kind that can resist white supremacy, and it's a kind that can be managed to make sure that the kind of anger does what it needs to do to make the world better. Mm-hmm. And what I just said is taken from bits and pieces of the Uses of Anger essay by Audre Lorde. And so that's why I kind of call it Lordean rage, although she doesn't theorize. And I don't know if she'll turn over in her grave me calling it this. But
it'd be like, finally.
The features that I'm basically suggesting is a lot of the stuff that she lays out in that essay. So I'm inspired by that essay. And kind of conceiving of a kind of anger, anti-racist anger that I see in the world, not only just expressing the essay, but I actually see in the world that I've seen through freedom fighters, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the gist of what Lordean rage is. And you contrast that with the rage that we saw on the Capitol on January 6th. Contrast that with Charlottesville. Contrast that with people who only want justice for themselves, even if they are a Black person, right? This is a very inclusive anger. It's concerned about justice for us all. It's concerned about aiming for a radical transformation of our world. It wants to do something in the world, and it does indeed do something in the world. You mentioned action, and I guess it's important to a little bit talk about that not only does it motivate the kind of productive action that I'm talking about, but I'm also trying to get us to reimagine what action really means, right? So a lot of people think that action can only be manifested when you go out into the protests and you march. But also what I'm trying to challenge people to see is simply just having it as a Black person that works in a white organization, right? And still being comfortable and confident that when you witness a wrongdoing, you know, you feel that anger inside. Like that's an act of resistance too. So it's about action. But that action is very, 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 very broad. But it has a tendency to make the world better, describe value. It's not just for the wrongdoer to witness, but it's also for those who are oppressed to witness. But that's Lordean rage.
And why it's interesting. I know in the book, and one thing that I really loved about the book, one of the many things, is how accessible the language is, so that here I am coming to it, not knowing anything about moral psychology, knowing about certain activism, not having read really about, I haven't read Lord's piece, so not having read about the uses of anger toward activism, and hearing so much, especially as Black women, you know, that the angry woman trope, right? And you are saying, nah, that's not it. Nah, this gaslighting stops here. Right. And so with the young people, going back to your classroom, how are they engaging in these philosophies? And what are their responses to it?
So one of the questions, so you ask the question, you know, what does it mean to do philosophy? So when I take my course, they have that question, right? So they may take a course, they may have, either they're taking my course because they heard through the grapevine, that I'm probably someone that they should take, right? Or they take the course because philosophy sounds cool, although in both categories, they have no idea what philosophy is, right? So they take it out of curiosity. So I take it very serious for it to be my job to introduce these young people to this strange academic profession that I'm in. And the reason why I say it's strange, because I think we meet medical practitioners all the time. We know, I mean, that's not a strange phenomenon to, you know, as far as a doctor is concerned. But a lot of people don't meet a lot of people with PhDs in philosophy. But also a lot of people don't meet a lot of Black people in philosophy and a lot of Black women in philosophy. So just to tell you how rare I am, less than 60 Black women have PhDs in philosophy in the United States. Wow. It's even less in other parts of the world. And that's out of 14,000 philosophers with PhDs. So we're a rare breed. So I take it as my job to introduce these individuals to what this philosophical enterprise or exercise is all about. Right. And for me, I think is that what I want to show them is that all the questions that you have, whether that's you're on social media, whether you're reading the book, I bet that you've asked philosophical questions. So I want them to know kind of what philosophical questions are, right? And to kind of crown them as philosophers, although they may not have a PhD, and to suggest that when they enter into my classroom, the only thing I'm going to teach you is how to be a better philosopher, but you already are a philosopher. And I just try to get them to have confidence with the questions they ask more questions, And hopefully they'll get some answers, if not from me, from each other. But some of the questions, particularly when I taught Lord last semester in a class called Philosophical Issues of Race and Gender. Mm-hmm. And so they were introduced to some of the essays in Sister Outsider. So we're reading Lord, who's not a philosopher, in a philosophy mm-hmm. course. And all I told them was, like, listen, you probably would have picked this class in one of your Jimmy Stuggs classes. You probably would have picked mm-hmm. this book up. What mm-hmm. I'm going to try to help you do is to read Lord through a philosophical lens. That mm-hmm. means that we try to find the argument in Lord. As much as she's wonderful rhetoric, she's making an argument, right? Mm-hmm. We're not going to take certain kinds of words or sentences for granted, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to try to figure out, like, how is she trying to address the world in which she sees, right? How is she trying to criticize it? How is she trying to change it? What more questions do she present to us after we read the essay? So I'm engaging mm-hmm. with her work as a philosophical mm-hmm. text. So I take that to be my contribution. Because even if they would have read Lord on the bookshelves, they probably would not have read it through a philosophical lens. So I'm just trying to bring up a philosopher in them and introduce them to the questions, the content that they probably would have encountered on social media, but engage them mm-hmm. in a more philosophical mode, if you might say.
Wow. That's so impressive. You know, she shows up in a lot of my middle grade literature.
I know.
I'm always sneaking Lord in there because she is such a force for change, but also thinking, you know, to survive in the mouth of this dragon we once called America, we call America, we must learn the first and most important lesson that we were never meant to survive. Like just those words alone, you know,
right.
You speak them to a 10-year-old and they see the impact, they see the questions right. starting to form. And so much of her writing is like that. And the same way that I feel like, you know, the case for rage is like that, in that it raises a lot of questions and you go on to answer them, but in a way that you take your time. And I don't feel like I'm reading a textbook. I feel like I'm reading someone who has a deep passion for helping me to understand something. And I just feel like I learned so much.
That's glad to hear.
I'm jumping around the book because I don't want to assume anyone's read it. And so I don't want to position it with this sense that people have yet. I know y'all are going to read it. I know you're going to love it. And I also on my drive from DC, listened to some of the audiobook, which is also really well done. And I'm going to listen to the audiobook again because I do hold information better that way when I'm not outlining. And one thing that I missed, I think it was in chapter 2, where you talked about the three different kinds of was it pushback? Can you just talk? You know what I'm talking about. Thank you.
So you're not talking about three kinds of anger, but kind of the arguments that people have against anger.
If it can be against anger. Yes.
So this is good because it's interesting on Twitter. Anytime someone reposts something about my book, their Twitter friends have a tendency to just read the tweet, which is the title of my book, The Case for Rage, and immediately says, anger is bad. Right. I think I just saw something before I came on where the response wasn't that anger was bad. The immediate response and the only response was violence was bad. So immediately, right, what's happening is that they're conflating violence with anger. Mm-hmm. And they're stuck in what I kind of call kind of the tendency to paint anger in broad strokes in which we look at anger as if it's just one thing, which is bad. Mm-hmm. So don't feel it. Right. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, I get it. Right. I can understand if someone feels that way, but I think someone is making a mistake in doing so. Right. There's a variety mm-hmm. of different angers and there's a lot of negative anger, in particularly in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the problem with that anger is not that it's anger, but it's a kind of anger given its features, that's the thing that makes it problematic. And I'm trying to say that the case for rage that I'm making is a loading and rage case. But people are overcritical and concerned about anger, and particularly concerned about it in the context of anti-racist struggle. So mm-hmm. one of the concerns someone might say, well, okay, so even though Aisha, you told me that anger is good, well, you know, it can turn people off. So if you want people to be on your side, particularly let's just say if you want the powerful to give into your demands, there's something about anger that can just turn them off. It can make them defensive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you want to come at them with more loving responses. Be like King, in which you can change their hearts and their minds. So one of the things I say about that is, you know, I really do challenge that assumption, right? Because mm-hmm. even King, he used love. And last time I heard, according to the historical record, he was shot and killed. Right. Mm-hmm. So to tell me that only if you use this emotion in anti-racist struggle will people hear you. Well, I have empirical evidence that suggests that even the most positive emotions didn't allow everyone to hear resistance. Mm-hmm. Right. So then it forces me to ask, what is really the problem? Right. So mm-hmm. saying that anger is the problem, is the reason why people do not listen, is to me an insincere kind of claim. And it makes me mm-hmm. it brings me back to the first page of the essay, Uses of Anger, where Audre Lorde says that she's given a talk and a white feminist comes to her and after the talk and says, well, tell me how you feel, but don't say it too loudly or I cannot hear you. And then Audre Lorde's response was, is it the way I say it or is it what I say? And you're afraid that what I say will change your life, right? Mm. So I turn that back on that criticism. It's like, is it really the anger of protesters? Is it mm-hmm. or is it what that anger communicates? Are you afraid mm-hmm. that anger is going to force you to let go of your white supremacy and your anti-black, mm-hmm. you know, your anti-black hatred, right? Mm-hmm. And then I suggest, you know, if anger really is the problem and if that's standing in the way of true allyship, then perhaps you're not yet ready to be an ally, right? Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that I'm trying to say in the book is that the problem is racism. The problem is anger, which is mm-hmm. the response to racism. Yes. It's mm-hmm. also just insincere. But another attack that someone might say, was like, yeah, Maisha, okay. However, we all know that anger is going to lead, it's kind of productive. It's going to lead you to engage in violence, right? Mm-hmm. But one of the things I say, well, according to the psychological research, is that it's not necessarily anger that leads you to violence. It's a suppression and repression of anger, and not just anger. We know that there are other emotions like fear that are more apt to motivate mm-hmm. you to engage mm-hmm. in violence, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's why in the last chapter, I suggest that people express their anger, right? That's the thing that's mm-hmm. going to solve the violence issue, not the suppression mm-hmm. and the repression of anger. And that's one of the things mm-hmm. that Baldwin was very much concerned about.
Yeah.
He's mm-hmm. like, you know, white people have these black people around serving them. But he says, you know, it's that chauffeur who you should be afraid of because he suppresses his anger. And one day it's going to mm-hmm. manifest in the streets. And that's when he says it's going to be a fire next time. Right. Mm-hmm. And so those are some of the criticisms that I see in the space. Mm-hmm. And I try to address those criticisms mm-hmm. and hopefully quiet those criticisms.
Because so much of what you're talking about is that anger being targeted toward the work of anti-racism, mm-hmm. you know, anti-racist work and not just, you know, throwing it out there and having, but it's a very intentional kind of anger. And you also talk about who's allowed to be angry,
right.
you know, right. so it is really interesting that what you talk about, and I'm paraphrasing, in terms of a white man who's angry is seen as powerful, right? And right. listened to, and the opposite is true of other folks. But you were talking about allies, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about rage renegades, and mm-hmm. And especially in, I think, and until I read this book, I was like, oh, shoot, that did happen in terms of Naked Athena and the vet in Portland.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So one of the things that I wanted to address is that although I'm making a case, I wanted to end the last three chapters talking about ways to make sure that the anger actually does what it has the potential to do. And that's really up to us. Right. Mm-hmm, so the last mm-hmm. two chapters really talk about anger management. Mm-hmm. And the last chapter more explicitly, but the second to last chapter, which is the Rage Renegades chapter, talks about anger management dealing with white allies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I call white allies who are angry at racism, rage renegades. And I call them Rage Renegades because I'm going to try to quote myself here, is that although they live in a white supremacist society that was designed to benefit them, they express anger at such a society, right? And in a way, they kind of resist, this kind of world that was made for them. But I want to say, and Rage Renegades are good to have in the world. I want white people. I mean, we saw last summer, right? Mm-hmm. White people in Portland. We saw white people angry at racism, right, in the street. Mm-hmm. trying to fight and push back against white supremacist claims, et cetera, and racial injustice. So I think it's a good thing to have in the world. Mm-hmm. But just because you feel anger doesn't necessarily mean that you can't use that same anger to reify the very white supremacy that you are fighting against, right? Mm-hmm. And so basically what I try to do is to kind of reveal how even with anger, whiteness can creep in and even taint the most noble emotion. Right. So here's one way that it can happen. So one way that it can happen, you kind of alluded to this, is that a rage renegade might think that his anger matters more than the anger of the racially oppressed. Right. And it may be hard to not believe this when your anger is listened to, when your anger is respected, when your anger, you're not judged in the stereotypical manner in which Black folks is judged. Right. So you may have the opportunity to get invited to write that op-ed or to be on that panel about racism because your anger is just perceived as differently. And you just might think that, hey, my anger matters more than these people. So I'm going to use my anger, in the cause of white saviorism or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. And I want to kind of try to reveal even those kind of racial assumptions that a white person may have and just try to make them aware that your anger is, it doesn't mean more. Mm-hmm. And I simply suggest that when you do that, you can engage in destructive actions, like you don't provide space for people of color mm-hmm. to express their emotions. You may even try to one up them in the emotional department. So an angry person might say, I am angry. And you say, I am angrier. You might think that you're Blacker than a Black person whose anger don't match yours. Right. Those are some of the mistakes that I think that someone can make. And so I try to reveal as a philosopher, I try to reveal and uncover things mm-hmm. that we probably have taken for granted that we probably have not seen. So try to reveal those mistakes and try mm-hmm. to warn people and give them some ways to make sure that they don't make those kinds of mistakes. And there's several, I think I raised four mistakes that rage renegades can make. I think the Naked Athena one, I think it's just an example of how even whiteness can upstage a movement and making sure that even though you are just committed and you feel it, make sure that you kind of step out the way sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think the motto that I used was the Navy officer who got beat with batons. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And even in his interview, he said, if I wasn't white, we would not be having this interview. Mm-hmm. And I think the focus should be off of me and be back on the reason why we're in these streets, which is Black Lives Matter. That's an exemplar, right? Who's angry. That's the reason why he came out. But he knows how to make room for people of color. He knows how to make that space. To be in the background, even though he feels it. And so I think he's an exemplar of what a rage renegade can be and should be. And I'm just trying to send out a warning and a guide to make sure that white folk do right by their anti-racist anger.
Wow. But tell the Naked Athena story, which is the opposite story.
right. So it's like, so the Naked Athena, woman of color, I think I contrast her, put her in the same category of Portland Walls and Moms, right? These are people mm-hmm. who are well-intentioned, right? Mm-hmm. Coming out mm-hmm. to the protest and mm-hmm. try to do what they can to do. But when you, Naked Athena, she basically took her clothes off and was striking yoga poses in front of federal agents. Striking yoga poses, spreading her legs wide open. Listen, do you, boo. But for some people, this was like upstaging the movement. Like kind of lacked a kind of consciousness to say, hey, if we're here for Black Lives Matter, you showing mm-hmm. your whatever, maybe mm-hmm. distracted in a certain kind of way. So be mindful of the ways that even though we're mm-hmm. angry, one's body, one's whiteness or one's positioning can be a distraction from what matters. And to be aware of that, to be aware of that.
That's such a good point. There's a question. So just a reminder that Maisha's book is available at Greenlight. The information is in the chat. And if you're not here in Brooklyn, they do ship books to you. Somebody's asking, and Chelsea, maybe you can answer this in the chat. How do they get an autographed copy of tonight's book? Which is a great question. I know how to get mine, but And then I have a question from William Breeze, and I haven't read it all, but I'm looking at it. Apologies, I have only just begun your book, Dr. Cherry. It seems fair to say that white rage mostly manifests in destructive ways as opposed to the restorative, creative Lordian rage you've described. I wonder if you might address ways you see a way for white allies to access rage in the interest of anti-racist activism. Even among well-meaning white folks, the anger still destroys, silences the voices of the people of color who should be most hearing. And I think you started to answer this a little bit, and I don't know if you wanna expand on it a little
bit. So you're gonna get to chapter six very soon, and I think that's gonna answer the latter part of your question. I'm talking to you, the questionnaire. But I think what was said allowed me to make a kind of clarify something. Mm-hmm. So I'm very careful with calling the anger of white folks in the service of anti-racist struggle white rage, right? I want to say that they have Lordian rage. They're just white people with Lordian rage. The reason why I want to do that, because when I think about white rage, I think about Kara Anderson's use of the word, historian from Emory University, came out with a book of white rage. And her account of white rage is basically a rage that has always been used in the service of racist struggle, right? Racist action, right? White rage for her is a rage that happens when you want to undo the efforts of Reconstruction. White rage is the rage that white folks enact in order to respond to the gains of Brown versus Board of Education. That is to say that what white rage does is roll back moral and racial progress. Right? White rage is what happened in Tulsa, right? So I want to make a distinction between the kind of anger that rage renegades have and the white rage. But I must say that I attempt to be clever. I don't know, Jackie, if you found me to be clever in the first chapter when I call the rage white rage as yes. opposed to white rage. And I call it white rage because one of the features of this kind of white rage, and the white rage that I talk about is a more destructive kind, the kind of Charlottesville kind of rage, is that you aim to eliminate the person that you think is responsible for any kind of injustice that you are experiencing. You aim to wipe them out. You aim to eliminate them. And that's fueled by hatred. So when you think about what happened in Charlottesville, these are individuals who are marching, saying, you would not replace me, right? This elimination, which is very contrasted with Lordian rage, is not about inclusion. It's about exclusion, right? And that's a very destructive kind of rage. So I don't call it white. I call it wipe. There's another destructive rage that I call rogue rage. But I want to reserve the phrase white rage specifically in the spirit, not just of what the historian Carl Anderson raises, but how a lot of race scholars have used white rage. It's a destructive kind. But I want to say that white people can have Lordian rage and they are called rage renegades. But that doesn't mean that they can't make any mistakes. And so I try to point that out. And you can read more about in more detail those mistakes that I raised in chapter six. Yeah.
Thank you for that. Oh, and William, I see you're from Nelsonville. That's where my people are from, Nelsonville, Ohio. Bug eye to the bone. So thanks for that question. Celeste Turner wants to know, do you think it would help if we pointed out to white allies, and I'm going to move away from white allies in a minute, white allies, the history of how their help has at times set the movement back?
Yeah. So I one of the other kind of ways in which I say rage renegading can go wrong is white saviorism, right? So we're probably familiar with white saviorism, the whole notion that Black people need saving and only white people can save them. And usually when you engage in any kind of white saviorism, any kind of productive action that you engage in, it's just so you can get kind of release from your little emotional kind of experience. And then you go home forgetting about Black lives or whatever, because you just release your anger in a protest. But the reason, and so I think that even with anger, one can use one's anger in the service of white saviorism. And I kind of lay out ways that can just go wrong. And I basically end up saying, listen, Lordian rage can still do its thing without white people ever experiencing it. Right? It can still say that Black lives matter. It can still motivate productive action. A person with a Black person or an Asian American or whoever with Lordian rage can still use their rage to resist racial and injustice or white supremacy. White people need to have it in order for those things to happen, right? It's a good thing if white people join the struggle, and have this particular anger. But I want to remind white folk that your anger will not save us, right? That freedom doesn't require your presence, and that's a reminder. The struggle is so much, I'm hesitant to say easier. It's fun when everybody can join in, but I'm confident with saying that white anger is not the thing that's going to save us alone, right? That's just a way in which I think that one can think, if one is white, that their anger is required in order to help people of color along. And I want to remind them that it's not, it's a good thing. It can help in the struggle, but it's not required.
So one thing that I'm thinking about is, I don't know if you got it growing up, but culturally I would get, things said to me, like, I'll give you something to cry about, or you better not stop yeah. your foot, or, I know you didn't just roll your eyes at me. There was a way in which culturally so much of our anger had to be hidden, else, we get out behind, it felt like some kind of, it was offensive to our parents, right?
Right.
I, for one, was never allowed to have a temper tantrum. And right. I think especially families coming out of the South, that was the case. So in so many ways, we had to unlearn the means by which we could express anger. And right. And so what do you say to the people who don't even remember how to express that anger and use it as an anti-racist tool and use it as a tool against racism?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's one of the things that I want to be careful with this, that I'm up against, right, to really convince people, right, because we've been so ingrained. I mean, one of the things that we're taught, not just about anger, but we are taught about emotions, what emotions we should express, what emotions we shouldn't express when we're babies. Mm-hmm. Like the evidence is just there, right? Mm-hmm. TV that we watch, the kind of culture milieu that we're in school, we're taught what emotions are acceptable and which ones are not.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Also, we're also taught, based on our gendered presentation, about what emotions are acceptable. So one of the things that I argue in the book is that, listen, emotions are gendered and they're also racialized.
Mm-hmm.
So I know a lot of boys who were taught not to cry, but anger was allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And us girls who gendered as girls, it was more acceptable for us to cry than it was for us to be angry, right? Mm-hmm. And so people have learned, through this kind of cultural programming, what emotions they should express. And it's gendered because of just our kind of feminine and masculine expectations of what we take to be virtuous for one gender and a vice for another gender, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we learned about it. But also racially, we're also taught this. Right. So it's not just that we're taught, watch your tone, blah, blah, blah. But make sure you also watch your tone when you talk to police officers. And when I see these videos, the most irate videos that I see are not Black people responding to the police, cursing them out. It's white people. Right. Because they have just given. I mean, one might say that they've been trained, particularly in a racial context, that they can just freely express themselves emotionally and there will be no life or death consequences for doing so. Like even that is a training. And that just goes to show that emotions are also racialized. I mean, you talked about in the beginning about the stereotype of the angry Black woman, right? So where did that stereotype come from? I mean, the stereotype is a way to program and to teach us how we ought to act. And if we want to represent women and Black women particularly, right? We got to be careful, because in this one instance of us going off, whole Black women, the whole project of Black womanhood, the whole project is just going to so keep it in. You don't want them to think that you're the angry Black woman, right? But I say that even that stereotype, I mean, one of the best ways that you can get people to be under control and do the things that you say is to have them to self-police themselves. And I think one of the things that stereotype has done is it allow Black women to self-police themselves. You don't need a white person to say, calm down. You already built up this internal mechanism to say, okay, Black woman stereotype, be quiet. Don't say anything in this room. That's a form of control, because people know the power. And I'm just gonna say, power of people who look like me is a powerful thing, right? Mm-hmm. Our anger is a powerful thing. History shows our anger, Annie Lou Hamer, Ida B. Wells, our anger is a very powerful thing. So what's the best way to get us to shut up? Let's create this stereotype to put us in our place, right? And so, which we're always careful of protecting the race by minimizing our emotions. So we have all that training happening. One of the things that I want to say in the book is I want to tell you that anger is a good thing. And it's a good, despite what you've been taught, it's a good thing because it's a way to express value. It's a way to protest. It's the way to say that you matter and those that you're angry on behalf of matter. It's a way to change the world. It's a way to resist destructive things in our world. And if it has these particular features, then anger is for you, right? I wrote this book as a love letter to those who are angry and trying to make sense of it, those who feel ashamed of having it. And the shame comes from all that teaching. So I'm hoping that the book can undo, if you know that it's this beautiful thing and this powerful thing, I'm hoping that that will kind of help the deprogramming, right? And any concerns you have about the anger, I'm hopefully that the anger management chapter will kind of give you the tools necessary to make sure that you still feel comfortable in your shoes as an angry person, but don't get rid of it. That's what the man, don't get rid of it. Use it.
Man, you know, okay, so I'm just going to put this out to the universe since it's our boys, our man's Jason Reynolds' birthday. I would
Happy
love,
birthday, Jason.
You know, he ain't on here, he's somewhere partying. He's going to lie tomorrow and say he was, though.
Right.
But I would love to see a version of this for young people before that anger gets unlearned. So I'm just putting that out into
the
world.
Let's put it out there.
Yes, yes. And I just love what you just said. And what you say in the book about value, about our value and the need to have that recognized and by us and by the world. I know we're running out of time. I'm interested. I have two questions. Another question about this book. How did you feel when you finished it? When you finished writing it?
Okay, so one thing that I felt was finally. And the reason why I said finally is, you know, it takes a long time to think. Right, to develop your ideas and your thoughts and to get them down in which they can really persuade people. So that just takes time. Book production also takes time. And trying to be patient with that process, but also patient with myself. And so when I finished it, although in my mind I'm thinking, oh, I'm finishing this late, right? I wish activists had this in their hands last year or 2 years ago or 3 years ago. But that thinking is to suggest that there would never be a reason why people would ever be angry about because the world has just improved racially, right? So I got over that real quick. But I basically said, finally, I mean, and it's not to say, I don't mean that in a very strict time frame kind of thing, but finally in the sense that, hey, I'm an academic, public intellectual. My contribution is thinking. And I felt that I wasn't contributing. I mean, I'm just going to be honest. Last year when things were going on last summer, I felt like I wasn't doing my part, although I was doing my part behind the scenes. And so when I finished, I felt finally I can do what I'm here to do and the ways that I can do it for the struggle.
Nice. Wow. Well, you did your thing. So
thank you.
Can you talk a little bit about the failures of forgiveness?
So someone might think, well, you're making a case for rage. So you're against forgiveness too, right? So I must say that the title has less to do with forgiveness itself and more to do with us who are very interested in and have high expectations for forgiveness, right? One of the things I'm just very interested in as a thinker is to try to get us to think very differently about something that we thought we had a good grasp on as human beings, right? So you can, you know, in this book, I'm trying to say, hey, you thought anger was this, but I'm going to tell you that it's far more productive. It's far more beautiful, right? And I think with the book that I'm working on, you thought forgiveness was just the letting go of anger. And when you did that, we can run off into the sunset or ride off into the sunset together. I'm trying to expand your thinking about what forgiveness is. It could be that in one instance, It could be something else in another instance, right? It could be a whole bunch of things, which I kind of talk about. And I basically says, well, once we begin to kind of expand our minds about what forgiveness could be, that it doesn't always look like one thing, what I want to suggest is that that's going to have an impact on our relationships at home, our relationships at work, our relationship when it comes to racial reconciliation in the public sphere is going to have an impact on canceling online. It's going to affect us in very positive ways. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the things that I'm concerned about is that forgiveness has been used as a silencing tool to get Black folks to be quiet, to get white folk not to do the real work that's required for any kind of repair. It's being used to make abusive women go back to their abusive husbands. Mm-hmm. And I want to expose all of that and get us to use forgiveness much more ethically in ways that can get us closer to what we think is repair, as opposed to undoing and creating more things that requires repair.
I'm here for it and I am ready for it. So we have like 5 more minutes and there are a lot of shout outs thanking you for writing this book. Charlotte Sherman says, thank you for writing this book. We have so much to be enraged about. And the gaslighting repression seems to so dehumanizing. I have to say, you do talk about the gaslighting in the book. And it's at no point, and this is another thing I loved about it, is there talk of it being dehumanizing. You know, I think one thing that you really see in seeing us is that you can't kill the spirit, you know? Right. And I think that's what feels so healing about this book is the way that you see us and you see that, we still have this, and we still have this work to do and we still have this power to do the work. And, you know, we still have this fire. The fire has not been put out. Can you talk a little, I've been reading a lot of Ida B. Wells lately, lots and lots of Ida B. Wells. And there's this one great thing that happens on the train. She's getting kicked off the train because she's sitting in the women's car and they want her to move to a smoking car, even though she has a first class ticket. And they try to physically drag her off the train and she bites the guy's hand. Like she fights to the finish to get off this train. And
take him to court.
Sued him and won. And then of course, you know, whiteness prevailed and they took that money back. But In researching it, I kept saying, how did she get to be this person? You know, how did she, you know, even, and Fannie Lou Hamer, how did she find that voice to speak? And I want to ask you that for you in terms of coming to being able to do this work around activism, around anger, around forgiveness, around speaking truth to power in a very new way. And I think that's what's another thing that's so exciting. This is such a new way and I know Audre Lorde was a teacher in this way and did break the ground. But for us in the 21st century, this is new. You know, this is something that has been so deeply silenced. And Audre Lorde also, like James Baldwin, people learned of her later, those who weren't, you know, in the know. So for you, how did this journey happen?
Yeah, I don't know how to fully answer the question. So I answered it in part, right? Yeah. You mentioned those individuals and I gotta say, the Black radical tradition has been filled with exemplars of how to do this kind of thing. And one can argue that they were able to do this kind of thing in the most horrendous and atrocious of situations that are very unlike our own, right? Mm-hmm. So So thinking about them as exemplars has been very inspirational to me. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm just that kind of person. I'm inspired by others, right? Mm-hmm. That's why I had to be very careful about the movies that I watch, right? I remember when I was younger, I watched New Jack City. I thought I was a drug dealer afterwards. I mean, I'm just very impressionable, okay? Just put that out there. I'm very impressionable. So I'm very, you know, they have served as exemplars to me, and they have been very inspirational to me. You know, some people may be surprised about the kind of exemplars that I raised in the book, right? Because when they think about anger, they may be surprised I don't mention like Malcolm X or Cleaver, any of the Black Panther folk, or any of those Nat Turner, any of these more radical men. And you know, in some ways we hear those individuals and we tend to think, oh, that's, they use anger, you know, and kind of conflate anger with masculinity and all these charismatic figures. And I want to say, listen, they may have been angry, but Black women has also been angry and they found ways to use it. Yes. And it was much more, you know, I can even argue that it was probably even more risky for them to express it. But, I mean, those are the people that I'm most inspired by. Mm-hmm. So Black women, like you mentioned Ida B. Wells, I don't know how they did it. I mean, there are some people in our generation who would say, well, if I was enslaved, I would have ran away. You know what? I'm not too sure that that would have been me. Okay. I don't know. Right. But I know who indeed resisted some stuff and during their time period. And Ida B. Wells was one of them. I mean, you mentioned the car situation. I mean, you think about the stuff she wrote was inflammatory, not just the white folks, but also to the Black community. I mean, they ran her out of town, like they burned her press down.
Yeah.
And she continued to talk about lynching. And she traveled Europe all by herself and didn't get support from a lot of Black men that she thought she would get report. I mean, this woman was fierce. Mm-hmm. And if I'm trying to make sense of what was it, anger is one of those things, right? When I think about what psychology says about anger, it increases our self-belief. It makes us take certain kinds of risks. That's Ida B. Wells. And so I'm inspired by how she used her anger, how she was able to use her anger in the struggle, you know, against against racism, against lynching, and so many other things. That's my inspiration. That's why I'm able to have some kind of boldness in a much better world that still needs to be improved. But they are the reason. Like Newton said, I stand on the shoulders of giants. I stand on the shoulders of Black feminist giants. They show the way, and they continue to show the way and provide the inspiration.
Well, thank you. And thank you to the ancestors for giving us those shoulders. So it's been great talking to you, Maisha. And again, likewise, everyone, Greenlight Bookstore, The Case for Rage, Maisha, Dr. Maisha Cherry, so PhD, y'all. Thanks for being here. And
thank you so much.
To see you in person at some point soon.
Soon.
Yes. Congrats again on this brilliant book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Maisha and Jacqueline, for such a wonderful conversation. And thank all of you for sharing the space for conversation and connection with us tonight. A reminder, like Jacqueline said, that you can buy The Case for Rage and Maisha's other books and Jacqueline's books from Greenlight Bookstore. If you're here in Brooklyn with us, we're open at our Flatbush and our Fulton Street locations, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. every day of the week. Thank you all so much again for such a wonderful evening, and have a wonderful rest of your night.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro FM, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. On the Greenlight website, you can also find links to purchase the books discussed in this episode and many more, as well as information about Greenlight's store locations and shopping hours. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.